Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are, what time of the day you're listening to this episode of Talking the Blues. Andy and George, hello to you both.
G'day, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hope you're both well.
Why?
Good.
Fair enough, you know, under the horrific strain.
Well, let's not even go there as to what the strain is about. Let's stick to the Everton element of the strain, shall we? Surprisingly, in reasonably good mood, I think, given where we find ourselves, obviously not to necessarily our own fault, but back in the bottom three. But I get the feeling that most Evertonians were fairly happy with how Saturday went.
I think it's probably fair to say that we're happy with the outcome at the end, with the last gasp equaliser that sent everybody home happy. Probably equally, or almost as equally pleased that, despite the fact he scored a brace of goals against us of the highest quality, both of them, Richarlison chose not to celebrate, and I think that spoke volumes about him as a person. The fact that he was, when after the first goal, he almost said sorry to the crowd. You know, but he's a professional. He was doing what he's paid to do. Left foot, right foot, two goals. He only needed a header for the perfect hat trick, but thankfully he didn't get that opportunity. But I think the team put in a good effort. They all fought hard. They all worked hard, and I think in the end we got our just desert, because while Spurs were clearly, in my opinion, the better team. If they hadn't have had Richarlison on the pitch, I think they would. I wouldn't say they were powder puff, but he clearly was the difference between the two sides on the day. Clearly,
we could do with somebody like Maddison.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of talk about Maddison, isn't there? But I mean, when he was at Leicester, he scored goals, and since he's been at Spurs, he's still playing well, but he's not been on the score sheet very often for Tottenham, which I'm delighted he wasn't on the score sheet on Saturday, obviously. But I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I'm not really bothered about James Maddison or Tottenham. I'm just bothered about where we're at and how we're coping with the situation and, if you like, the pressure, because it's not just pressure on the field, there's all the pressure from off the field as well. And I thought the players that Dyche selected on Saturday did a decent job. No, nobody had a mare. We looked a bit nervous early on. There was a few errant passes at the back and what have you. But, I mean, to have conceded that early goal and then kind of weathered the Spurs storm and then got back in the game. And clearly Dyche had sussed out how he wanted us to approach attacking Spurs, particularly from width and from set pieces and corners, you know, put pressure on the keeper. Which paid off. It was just a bit odd that we didn't carry it on so much in the second half, and he was comical in his post-match interview. When he was asked quite bluntly, you know, why wasn't Jack Harrison and co doing what they'd done so well in the first half and putting Vicario under pressure, and he said, I think they forgot to do it, which struck me as very ridiculously honest and quite amusing, considering the fact that, you know, had we carried on in that vein, who knows what might have happened. But, you know, at the end of the day, we got a point. I think we deserved the point. I mean, 1 point from six from Tottenham is disappointing, because I thought we played better at White Hart Lane than we actually did at Goodison on Saturday. But them's the breaks, as they say.
Yep.
What was your view on the game, George?
I sort of thought to myself, actually, these have been the best two games of the season. I've enjoyed both games against Spurs. I was absolutely, and I'm still hopping mad that we came away from White Hart Lane without a point. But they were two terrific games. And, you know, the players and us, the fans, should take some heart from that. I enjoyed the game. I think Andy's absolutely right. Tottenham were clearly a, you know, better side, a clearer way of wanting to play. But, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and Everton are where we are at the moment. And it was very, very honest. And, you know, if people are honest, there's nothing you can say except thanks. Well done. You did your best. You know, I thought he was slow to change things. I would have had Dobbin on 25 minutes before then, because actually Young was had done his job in the first half. Now it was time for a different plan. And I would urge him to put a little bit more faith in that boy. And, you know, sorry DCL hadn't got the header. I'm sure that would have made a difference to him. Who's next? Who do we play next?
City.
Ace them.
City are playing Brentford tonight, but we're there on for another midday kickoff next Saturday.
Right.
I think the next five are City, Palace, Brighton, West Ham, and then Man U.
15 points.
would be most gratefully welcomed.
I thought there were a lot of positives. You know, it was a drag to watch them kind of dominate the second half, because we had dominated the first half. And you go, why is this happening? Is this just legs? Or is it simply that they can pass the ball quicker and faster than we can? And, you know, my judgment would be, yes, they can. What was your take on the game, Paul?
I thought it was an unusual game, given that it was the early kickoff for the day. In the first instance, I think the atmosphere that was established by, and I think a lot of congratulations is the wrong word, but a lot of praise has to be given to the 1878 group and all of those people that were involved in yet again.
Yeah.
You know, making it demonstrable to anybody that was watching the game around the world how Evertonians currently feel about the Premier League and how the club feels about the Premier League.
I think also, Paul, I think considering the game that had the first visual protest was covered by Sky and got scant recognition, I think fair play to BT or TNT Sports, as it is now, on Saturday. They clearly showed it and talked about it. So, you know, we can all be critical of TV companies, but in fairness to them, on Saturday, they did it. They did the job that Sky should have done when we did the first visual protest with the placards against the Premier League. So fair play to BT. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I think that's a very fair point, Andy. I was going to talk about that later in the context.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, may as well talk about it now. But I think it puts Sky in quite a difficult position. Not that we should be concerned about their positioning. It's all of their own doing. In that, you know, there will be almost inevitably further protests.
Yeah.
Before we get the results either of the appeal or the results of the second commission, and we are going to appear in front of the Sky cameras again. I don't know if Saturday's game is that a Sky game? Is it on Saturday?
No, it's BT again.
Okay, but we will do quite clearly before we hear any results. And if we do, let's make the most of it as a fan base in putting Sky in a position where they can't ignore it any longer. I understand the reasons why they ignore it, and not that I agree with it.
What are the reasons why they ignore it?
Because Sky have effectively the same role that the Premier League has in terms of promoting the Premier League around the world. That they are... effectively, you know, co-investors in the Premier League. The amount of money that Sky has put into, and the importance that this Premier League has in terms of, you know, the Sky portfolio of sports events that it covers, means that they think editorially, at least, that they have to present the Premier League in what they consider to be the best possible light. Now,
so they've got an agenda.
Of course, they've got an agenda. Yeah. And I think it's incredibly naive to. I'm not calling you naive, Andy. I think it's incredibly naive of commentators of the game and people in the game not to recognise the fact that they have. I also think it's incredibly naive of Sky not to recognise their position and their duty, actually, as a promoter of the game, in the same way as the Premier League as a promoter of the game, and to treat their audience with a bit more respect,
absolutely,
and yeah. to bring some more greater authenticity and integrity to how they actually present the game.
Rock on.
We're all adults here. And I know a lot of children obviously watch the game and everything else, but
those children are television subscribers of the future.
Absolutely. And like anything in life, the product, if you might call the Premier League the product, it can only get better through honesty and integrity. Mm. There's no point in pretending that something is better or different from what it is, because the people who are actually running it are never going to change their behavior or adapt their rules or recognize what their faults are, what their weaknesses are, unless this is identified and brought to the public's attention. Mm. Now, we as Evertonians live and breathe this, and we are acutely aware of the consequences, of the many consequences of the way that the Premier League has been run for many, many years. But everybody else has to be as well. And football more generally, as we discussed a little bit last week, and certainly we've discussed on a number of occasions, this is not, this is about Everton, but it's not just about Everton, because this could be any one of a number of clubs at any time in the future.
Well, and it's all those clubs who are not deemed to be the big clubs. It's all those little clubs, all those minions.
Absolutely. And this is only one manifestation of the unfairness that exists within the Premier League itself. So for Sky to go all in with the Premier League and to not be objective and not to criticise and not to, I suppose they don't even have to criticise, they just have to ask the questions. Is from a business perspective, I think hopelessly naive, and I think it's something that will come back to haunt them. It won't change their relationship with the Premier League, of course, because ultimately that's a commercial relationship, but it might, and it should, change their relationship with their customer base.
Yeah.
And that's what they have, ultimately, what they have to be concerned with. And I think also there comes a point, and we haven't addressed this as a fan base yet, and football hasn't addressed it neither. There has to be a question mark over the other commercial relationships that exist between the sponsors of Premier League football, the sponsors of the broadcasters of Premier League football, and the sponsors of individual clubs, if everybody allows this farce to continue. Because, you know, if I was the brand manager or the brand director, the marketing director of a company that was spending millions of pounds with the Premier League or with a Premier League club, and I saw the type of press that is appearing in some quarters, and certainly the concerns are expressed by many, many football fans now, I would be extremely concerned about it, because from a marketing point of view, from a brand point of view, from a sponsorship point mm-hmm. of view, you're paying premium prices for what should be a premium product.
Yeah.
It may be a premium product on the pitch. That's a completely different argument, but, you know, generally accepted as being the best, however you want to define best, football league that there is, in terms of excitement, certainly in terms of exposure, etc. But also you have to consider, you know, if you're attaching your company name to football and to the Premier League in particular, and to Sky, its values. Do the values of modern football, of the Premier League, of Sky, for argument's sake, if you're advertising with Sky, do they represent the values of my business? And there must be, you know, there must be boardrooms around the country, if not globally, who are thinking, well, maybe we can spend our money elsewhere where these problems don't exist.
Oh,
yeah, that'll learn them.
Yeah.
I wasn't planning on getting into that speech so early, because I just want to go back to the match, and I think. I think the atmosphere was set by the behaviour and the approach that the fans took. I think visually, the yellow cards worked better than the pink cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think also from a messaging point of view, not saying that the Premier League was corrupt, but saying that they didn't know what they were doing.
Wholeheartedly
was
agree.
Was a more effective set of messaging, and was a more acceptable set of messaging,
yes,
for broadcasters, even if it wasn't necessarily acceptable to Sky.
Mm.
So again, you know, I think the people I wasn't party to any of these discussions, but I think the people behind this latest campaign, or this latest protest and campaign, have taken on board perhaps some of the comments that people have made, and they made some really wise decisions, and it was hugely effective. And whereas arguably, okay, Everton were unlucky against United in the sense that we conceded a wonder goal early on, I think it actually helped the team. Okay, we still conceded early on yet again on Saturday. But I still think it helped the team generally.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that they at 10 minutes when we were already 1-0 down helped re-energise the crowd as well.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, that came across very, very clearly.
Yeah, so, you know, the fact that we were 1-0 down after 4 minutes through, you know, a very, very good goal by Richarlison. The 10 minutes sort of reset, I think, reset the crowd.
Yeah.
And got everybody going again. It's interesting. I suspect I know the answer to this, but I think the crowd's reaction to Richarlison also says a lot about Everton Football Club.
Yeah.
And I was a little surprised by some of the negative reactions that have been expressed about the fans that respected Richarlison for the goal that he scored and for how he behaved after he'd scored.
Yeah.
What's been said negatively?
There's been comments that, you know, why are people still care about Richarlison? He's no longer a Blue, he's a Spurs player. And he was, you know, scoring a goal against us, was trying to hurt us, et cetera, et cetera. But that's his job. And I think he did his job. And then obviously he knows what our club means to us, the fans, and he knows what our club meant to him, and probably still does, otherwise he would have celebrated. And he's not the first former player who's come back and scored against us. I mean, Duncan McKenzie famously came back and scored against us and got applauded. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think Bob Latchford did too.
He did, for Swansea.
In his latter years when he went to Swansea.
Yeah.
So, you know, he won't be the first, and he probably won't be the last. And I think, you know, the first goal I thought was exceptional. The finish on the volley, you know, and the way he took the second one and bent it round, and, you know, that must have been incredibly hard for him not to celebrate scoring two such goals. But he knew where he was. He knew who it was against. And he knew he knew how the fans had celebrated his goals when he was in the blue shirt. And I actually thought he did himself tremendously well on Saturday. I'm sure there are some Spurs fans who maybe think, hang on a minute, you're a Spurs player now, you shouldn't still have shouldn't still be carrying a torch for Everton, but clearly the boy does, and you know, he did what he had to do for the club that pay his wages now, but it obviously resonated with him, you know, the impact it could have on the club that he loved when he played for us, and that he gave his all for us in every single game.
I think above all of that, Andy, it showed some maturity on his part,
yeah,
which, you know, is not a characteristic that has often been thrown at Richarlison, because, you know, he's quite often been considered to be petulant, and certainly in the early stages of his career, you know, throwing himself around and stuff of that nature, which, you know, seems to be an element of his game which is in decline, which is good to see. I think we saw a very mature, obviously a very skilled player on Saturday, and he, you know, he's absolutely in top in form. Is it 9 or 10 goals in?
It's nine and eight.
In 8 games, yeah. And you know, we're obviously here to talk about Everton, but when you consider that Tottenham lost, you know, their number one striker, Richarlison's really stepped into in not at the beginning of the season, but you know, in the last couple of months, has really stepped up, hasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and, not half.
You know, I don't like anybody scoring against Everton, but you know, I was pleased for him in a sense.
Mm. I mean, the other thing it highlighted, of course, and is what he is what we need, and that's a natural finisher. Because no disrespect to DCL or Beto, but that first strike, you know, 4 minutes in, he'd only touched the ball once prior to that, and that finish was so clean. It's just, it came naturally to him, and that's the big thing that we're lacking at the moment, is someone to get on the end of a cross or be in the right position. Who doesn't even think about it? He knows what he's doing, and the ball ends up in the onion bag.
And it's exactly, Andy. To me, it showed somebody with a level of intelligence, a footballing intelligence that we don't have. And that's not a criticism of any of our players in particular. It's just an observation. You know that area between the edge of the penalty box, where the semicircle is, and the penalty spot. Is where all the great goal scorers score goals.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to be an out and out number nine to occupy that space.
No.
And you know, Richarlison's not an out and out number nine.
No, I mean you've only got to think of someone like Tim Cahill, you know, who always seemed to put himself in the right position to get an effort on target and scored an inordinate amount of goals from a midfield position, because he had the awareness and the if you like the natural instinct to be where he went to get on the end of all those crosses and score so many goals for us.
And particularly for the first goal, I mean, he could just completely outfoxed our defence just by stepping back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, to be fair to Everton, I think we've seen Doucouré do. Not quite similar, but Doucouré scored a lot, you know, a lot of his goals from a very similar area in recent times, you know, which has become a feature of his game. He's obviously clearly not as good a goal scorer and not as natural a finisher, but he does occupy that space, which and again, I think it's such a difficult space for. Defences to defend against, because typically when the ball goes wide, central defenders drop back towards the 6 yard line to defend their goal, and all Richarlison had to do was just peel away a little bit and created the space, and thank you very much. Anyway, enough of Richarlison. The Everton response was good, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been very easy for Heads to have gone down after conceding such an early goal, and you know, and you would And you could kind of half expect it, Spurs to step on the gas and go for the jugular. And they probably did increase their work rate and effort, but Everton resisted them and then gradually grew back into the game. And like I said, Dyche had obviously worked out in his own mind that the way to get at Spurs was to pressure the keeper from set pieces and corners and crosses and what have you. And so it worked out. I mean, he did look... I think he's a good goalie, that Vicario, but he did look like he could be got at in the first half. And it was bizarre that we didn't do it to anything like the same intensity in the second half, but maybe Sean Dyche was right. Maybe they just forgot during the half-time break. Over a cup of tea, slice of orange, and checking the social media accounts.
Well, he did say it was not a deliberate tactic in the first half. He did say it was not so
deliberate to me.
Yeah, no. Clearly, it did. But he did also say that it was not something that they discussed beforehand.
Right.
You know, about getting the ball close to the goalkeeper. The other interesting thing was that it took Spurs an awful long time to work out how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could argue that they never quite worked out how to deal with it, particularly in the first half. But just the idea of putting somebody next to the goalkeeper, and putting Tarkowski next to the opposition's goalkeeper, you'd have thought that they would have immediately recognised the threat that presented and done something about it. But effectively, they didn't. I think about if I'd been the Spurs goalkeeper, I'd have been a bit disappointed with my defence.
Yeah.
Because they sort of left him to it, didn't they?
Mm. Yeah, he's not the most physical. He doesn't appear to be the biggest physical specimen, does he?
No, I think that was I think that was another point that was raised actually, that because he's quite slight, you know, he didn't. But no, I thought it was a very good game. At the end of the day, it was a good point. I think obviously Idrissa Gana-Gueye coming back into the side made a huge difference.
Mm.
For us, I think we looked tired in places, didn't we? I think both McNeil and Harrison didn't look to be in the best of form. But now, whether that's just a form issue, confidence issue, or just a tiredness issue, I don't know.
Yeah, certainly McNeil looks a little bit, probably only playing at about 85%, I would guess.
Yeah, and you know, that may be to do with his personal issues, and you know, obviously we wish him and his family all the very best.
Yeah.
Has he got issues with his family? I don't know about this.
His partner is quite seriously ill, so.
Oh no.
And he's had to spend a lot of time with her. So you know, clearly for anybody in those circumstances, it's difficult, but. Yeah. You know, such as the size of the Everton squad and such as the lack of depth, that I think if you're physically fit or anywhere close to being physically fit, you're playing.
Yeah.
It's probably more of a mental strain on him. He's probably is physically fit, but his head's possibly all over the place sometimes. And, you know, understandably, he's finding it hard to channel. Maybe he's finding it hard to channel for 90 minutes. Maybe what, you know, I was going to say, you talked about us using Dobbin a bit earlier, you know, bringing Dobbin on for Ashley Young was the right call. Maybe it should have been done earlier because Ashley Young had done his job. I mean, we've been critical of Ashley Young from day one at times, but I thought pushing him forward, further forward on Saturday ahead of Godfrey, we saw what Ashley Young was earlier in his career, which is a pretty decent winger. And he got a good number of crosses in and whatnot. And maybe if they'd made that, as you said, if they'd made that change earlier, or if they felt that Dwight McNeil was struggling a bit, you know, make the change for him earlier. But certainly, I agree with you. I think one way or the other, Iris, whoever comes off to make way for him, I think they've got to start using Lewis Dobbin earlier than the last 5 or 6 minutes. He's got to be given 20, 25 minutes at least to allow himself to get into the game and you know, hurt the opposition, because he's quick.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. What was your view on Beto?
Beto. I won't sit on the fence. He's one in a long line of agricultural centre forwards we've had. You were talking on another podcast about buying Bernie Wright from Walsall. That's what it reminds me of. He seems like, I'm sure he's a decent bloke, and I was thrilled for him when he scored against Newcastle, but he's not really frightening anybody, is he? His first touch is the touch of a JCB.
Yeah.
He may improve, you know, I mean, given what he is and what we are, I'm surprised Deitch hasn't yet tried DCL with Chimiti, who's a channel runner. You know, as soon as he brought Better One, they went up for a ball and they bumped into each other. This is, you know, for a man who was a centre-half in his playing career, I'm not sure how good a coach he is of centre-forwards.
That's a very good point, actually. And if you look at the number of goals that we've scored in the form tables, you know, we've scored one of the lowest number of goals in the league this season, which obviously to a degree,
and the highest number from free kicks.
Yeah. So if you extrapolate from that, how many goals have we scored, you know, indirect play as against indirect play, it's going to be a very, very small number.
And yet, you know, we're making loads of chances. We are, you know, statistically, we're pretty good on how many shots we get away, how many actual threats on goal we make. We're doing all right at that. We're just not putting them in the net.
That's the difference between teams that have got a striker in form and B, a natural striker.
Yes, quite.
You know, we've got two or three strikers. If you throw Chimiti in the mix, although we've seen precious little of him, but if you throw him in the mix with DCL and Beto, you know, who's the natural striker there? Not sure. And who's the striker in form? None of them.
Yeah, brutal.
You know, look elsewhere. You can pick just about any other side out of the division at the minute, and have they got a natural striker? Are they in form? Too many of them.
Well, it'll come round, but it's a hard wait. And you know, when he makes that change of DCL for Beto, I don't feel confident that that's going to change things very much.
No.
Yeah, we talked about it last season, didn't we? When we said, you know, where are the 40 goals going to come from? The 40 goals that you know, don't guarantee that you're going to stay in the league, but pretty much guarantee that you're going to stay in the league. And currently, we've got 26 goals in 23 games. So we're just about at the level where we will get to 40 goals. But, you know, those 26 goals put us in joint 18th place in the league in terms of goals scored. Only Burnley and Sheffield United have scored less.
Yep.
No. Whereas in contrast, if you look at, you know, the number of goals that we've conceded, only Liverpool, Arsenal and Manchester City have conceded less.
Yeah, it's a good defence.
It is, but we're dependent upon A, the goalkeeper, and B, making sure that we keep us, you know, our primary central defensive partnership.
Well, you know, that was a big bonus that the transfer window went through, and we didn't lose anybody, and we didn't gain anybody either, but we didn't lose anybody. I suppose the fire sale might happen in the summer when there's even more financial chaos around the place. Just before we leave the match, I thought Garner had a James Garner. I totally agree with you that the Garner game back gives a whole shape to the midfield where they can all go, oh, yeah, that makes sense now. We're not relying on somebody doing things that they're not good at. He knows exactly what he's doing. And I thought James Garner had an absolutely terrific first half, best I've seen him play for Everton. And then he, like the team really, he just couldn't keep it going in the second half. And you know, the second half was a bit tedious as Tottenham controlled it. And they hadn't controlled the first half, and we had. And you kind of think, well, how does that happen? Why is that energy levels? I'm not sure it is, because I keep reading stats about how we're running further and longer than everybody else. So I don't know how that... It's just, there's minute things that make a team work, isn't it? Confidence and stuff.
I think the running faster, running longer is a function of us not having the ball as much as the opposition have.
All right. Good point.
Which makes it difficult to... it makes it possible, as the statistics demonstrate, to stay in the game, i.e. we don't concede many goals, but it also makes it very difficult to score goals if you haven't got the ball.
Yeah.
And I think that's always been Dyche's problem, hasn't it? He isn't, as you said, George, he isn't a great attacking coach in the first instance. Therefore, if you had let's say it was 50-50 in terms of possession, are we likely to score more goals than the opposition? Possibly not, because many other teams are going to have better attacking coaches and possibly better attackers than we do. But if we've got the ball less than the opposition, and consistently that is the case sometimes, possession below 40%, which is quite significant. It just makes it more and more difficult, and it makes you then rely upon, the key moments are actually, when we get a free kick, when we get a corner. There's no point in talking about when we get a penalty, because we don't do those. But that's why it's become so, free kicks and corners have become so important to us, because otherwise, the chances of us scoring seem very, very, very low. I think we're second in the league, aren't we, in terms of goals scored in corners with, is it 13?
Yeah.
So, that's a very high percentage. That's 50% of our goals.
It's incredible, really, isn't it, when you think about it?
It is. And, especially when, I think earlier this season, there was quite a detailed analysis made of a very large number of games that showed that only less than 3% of corners, a goal is scored directly or within the first phase of play from a corner in only 3% of occasions. So one in 30 corners results in a goal in the Premier League.
Yeah, which is funny, isn't it? Because it doesn't matter what level of the game you're playing at or watching. Your side gets a corner, you immediately go, yeah, great. And it lifts the crowd. And yet, so as you just said, if only one in 30 or some ridiculously low percentage is actually producing, actually directly from the corner, why do we all get so excited about corners?
I think the other thing to say before we move on and talk about other things.
The one good thing about Everton corners under Sean Dyche is invariably we do get the ball past the first man.
Well, how many years has it taken us to do that?
Oh, dear me, don't go there.
you can go back to the Moyes days when shouts from the family enclosure about beating the first man.
Exactly. Exactly, but invariably we do that now because everyone seems to go to the back post.
Well, yeah, everything's swung into the back post, which is, yeah. I suppose, a function of having such a physically big team.
We've got some big men, Anana, yeah. Branthwaite, Godfrey, and Tarkowski are all big presences in the penalty area.
And DCL,
sure,
of course. Yeah. And DCL.
Yeah.
You know, sooner or later, we were bound to score something from a corner, from a header or a knock-on or whatever, but hey-ho.
I think the other thing to say is, you know, and obviously Dyche has his critics, particularly, you know, and many of those critics are Everton fans. One thing you can't criticise the team for, or very rarely can you criticise the team for, is its resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are statistics that say, you know, we don't win when we concede the first goal and everything else. But I think it's become a feature of this Everton side that we do, you know, we do keep battling to the end. And it was certainly obviously evident on Saturday that that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Having said all of that, and I'm not sure how we resolve this and certainly needs better football brain than mine, is how do we turn round our home form?
Yeah.
You know, we're 16th in the home form table. Okay, we're lower than that in the overall league table, but you know, there's only Luton, Sheffield United and Burnley that have generated more points at home than we have, and we've typically played one game more than everybody else.
All right.
And what is it? We've won 3, drawn 3, lost 6.
That's not good, is it?
And, you know, okay, our away form has been really good. Been a bit of a stato today. You know, we're in top 6 in terms of away form. Now, is that something that we can see through to the end of the season? Possibly. And I know we've got some so-called easier home games still to come for the rest of the season. But it must, if there is anything that's keeping Sean Dyche awake at night, it must be, how do I get more points at Goodison Park?
Yeah.
Because I think that's going to be the difference at the end of the day, isn't it? We will get more points away from home just by virtue of how we set up, and we're good on the break, and we're a much better team on the counter attack, which is obviously more difficult at home. But
is it because mentally you feel you should not play like that at home?
I think
historically, it's always the impetus is on the home team, because the away team, you know, you go into the game, you know, at 3 o'clock or kickoff time with a point, and you expect to come away with at least that point. Whereas for the home, you know, for the home side, well, you've got X number of 1,000 fans in your favour. You're on your own pitch. You're in your own, you know, your home locker room. Everything's comfortable. Everything. You should be able to go out and, or you're expected to go out and impose yourself on the opposition. Obviously, you know, there's going to be strong teams you're up against who will match you right from the start. But you know, given a fair crack of the whip, the home, you know, the emphasis is on the home team to go out and try and win the game, and for the away team to keep them at bay and nick it.
But I obviously that's correct, Andy. But the only conclusion you could draw from it is that we are a defensively minded team, and that when we're allowed to play defensively, let's go to, you know, an away match. Nobody minds if we go, no, you can just try and break down 2 lines of 4 and a few other bits and pieces, and we can break at speed when we feel like it.
Yeah.
But they obviously feel like they should not, could not, will not be, you know, nobody be too happy with us playing like that at home.
Well, I think it's the age-old thing about for Everton, and particularly under Sean Dyche. And I've never looked at his Burnley statistics, but I suspect his Burnley statistics will show the same, that at home they underperform slightly, and away from home they outperform. And it's all, I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that we have so little possession. It's difficult when you don't have the dominant possession when you're at home. I think it's also compounded by two factors. First of all, the lack of quality that we have up front, both in terms of delivery of the ball and, you know, obviously converting chances. I think aren't we in the top five across all European leagues in terms of the lowest conversion rate of chances to goals, which says a lot either about how we create chances, but it obviously says a great deal more about our ability to convert them. And you know, frankly, let's face it, even though, yes, James Garner had a good game and Idrissa Gueye had a good game on Saturday, we're not blessed with great midfielders, are we? We don't have creativity in midfield. No. And we haven't had that.
That's what I meant about Maddison early on in the podcast. We have nobody of that quality.
Mm. A playmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... you know, the reasons why we don't score many goals, the reasons why we struggle at home possibly are actually more apparent than we might think.
Maybe we're expecting too much of Anana in that playmaking role. You know, not of him, how can I put it, because of his, if you like, his age, his lack of experience. He's, you know, he's still a young man, and maybe he hasn't quite got there to the level that we want him, to the level of playmaking ability that we want him to have right now. And that's why people get frustrated with Onana at times.
How would you describe Onana as a midfielder?
Well, I would describe him as developing.
Yeah.
And he's developing in a very poor team, which is an interesting choice for him to have made. And I admire his character. I think he's got a lot of positives to him. And I feel for him that he hasn't got somebody, you know, and I'll pick, you're picking someone from history. But we can all think of people who would help that kid and make his life a lot easier because he's probably the most talented member of our midfield squad. We expect more from him than he probably knows how to give right now.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, bro. You know, he's clearly a talented footballer, but he hasn't quite got. He's not yet at the level that we need him to be right now.
The other answer to your question, sorry, Paul, would be in a perfect world, I think he's a box to box midfielder. I think he can tackle, and I think he can pick a pass, and I think he can run.
I would agree with all of those three characteristics. You know, he can. What I was going to say is he's obviously a different player, but the news that Fellaini is retiring from football this week made me think, actually, he reminds me a little bit of Fellaini when Fellaini first came to Everton. Mm. You know, this sounds strange, but like a body that's a little bit too big for him. You know, it's like he's running around in a suit that's too big.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't quite physically developed yet. I think it's unfortunate for Onana that, you know, some people said he's the next Patrick Vieira. And he may develop physically and become that sort of, you know, magnificent specimen, you know, the brilliant tackler, etc. But he's not there yet with that. And
no, it's just a shame that he's having to learn too much too fast, really.
And Georgia, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that he's in a sense he's isolated, and he's exposed by the deficiencies around him.
I'm afraid so.
And he's not given the protection that, you know, having a really good, you know, a fantastic midfielder alongside him would give him.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Sorry, but you know, we are short. The defense is quite good. The midfield is, and the attack is poor, and that's why we're where we are in the league. I mean, apart from the 10-point penalty and all that stuff, you know, And the other thing that worries me is every week, you know, a new name comes up, and I usually text one of you guys and go, "Who's Metcalf? What position does he play?" We are producing nothing from underneath. Dobbin is the only person who's made it through, and he's getting 7 minutes a game. It's great, you know. I mean, is there anything at all coming through underneath the first team squad?
I don't think there is, and I possibly shouldn't say this, but there are people I know within the game who say that Dobbin is the only one that's going to make it.
I can believe that. I think he's got, you know, the potential.
And certainly none of what's available to us. You know, we're just talking about Onana, who's obviously head and shoulders, literally, above anybody that would come up from the under-23s. And if we're talking about Onana struggling to, you know, be the player that he could be in this current Everton side with our, you know, the problems that we have, the deficiencies that we have, etc., it's almost impossible to see how anybody else could come in that's got less ability, less experience than Onana has, and do more.
Yeah, no, of course.
So it is a massive problem for Sean Dyche, and it's obviously a problem that couldn't be rectified in the January transfer window. And you made an interesting comment before, George, that, you know, it was good that we kept a hold of all of our players. Well, perhaps the fact that the transfer window itself was so dead, so moribund, whilst it didn't help us in allowing us to bring players in, and we didn't have the resources to bring them in anyway, it actually probably did help us to a degree in keeping the players that we've got.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, maybe, I would have settled for that beforehand.
Yeah, maybe there was a number of other clubs were very wary of spending big money in January, bearing in mind that we've been sanctioned, we've got a potential second sanction. And Forest have been looked at and whatnot. Although Forest did actually spend some money, didn't they?
I think Forest not the biggest spenders in the Premier League. Again,
yeah. maybe they don't care about sanctions. Maybe they think they're bulletproof. Maybe they've got better accountants than we have. Oh, hello. We're owned by an accountant.
Yeah, I think we've covered that one.
Oh,
so we've got City next.
City next, yep. Yeah. Should be a barrel of laughs. But I mean, to be fair though, I mean, I say that flippantly because nobody's going to give us a prayer going to the Etihad on Saturday. So it's a game that, you know, maybe the players can relax. Nobody's going to expect them to beat City. You know, they needn't go there tense. They can go out and play, and just try and play. Just do, you know, all we can ever hope is that they all work hard and give of their best on the day. And if it isn't good enough, then it isn't good enough. But I mean, obviously we should respect City because of the talent they've got and the depth of the squad that they've got. But I don't think we should kowtow and just be the cannon fodder for them. I think we should give them a game, and I'm sure we will give them a game. I think we'll, you know, hopefully we'll give them a good physical game as well.
I don't think that there's any chance of that happening, Andy, because I bet the players look forward to playing City and, you know, the big clubs more than they do playing Luton and Brighton.
Yeah, possibly.
Come on. You know, as you say, nothing to lose. They're not that good. You know, a bit of attitude and...
Yeah.
You know, the problem with playing City, which is always the problem when we play them, and is that they are very, very patient. And, you know, you can have a good hour against them and then they can change gear. And the bench, of course, is ludicrous.
Mm.
Every single member of their bench would walk straight into our first team and everybody knows it. So it's down to character. And whether, you know, I mean, what's the news on Doucouré? Is he likely to be there?
I don't know, George. I'm not kept up with
the. Later in the week for an answer on that one, bro.
Right.
I would say one thing. I'd rather us be playing City at City than playing them at Goodison.
Yes, it drives me mad when we play them there. They just wait and wait and then win 3-0.
I mean, yeah, alongside playing United at Goodison is probably the game I least look forward to.
Absolutely.
I thought I'd throw those bones at you two just to chew over.
Yeah, yeah. We're old lags now. We don't always rise to it.
So on top of all of that, all the off field stuff continues to rumble along.
What's happening with this appeal against the initial 10 points, Paul? When are we get some, or when do you think that there's likely to be some decisions made on that?
Well, it's been the appeal, such as it was, has been heard. And, you know, it's now finished. It's now up to the commission, and it's a new commission. It's three separate individuals. It's not the same individuals that heard the original case.
Right.
They're now making their deliberations and will produce a document very similar to the document that was produced last time, which will identify, A, what their decision is, and B, the reasons for their decision. And that could take, a couple of months.
What? This is crazy. this is crazy, because this new commission are aware that there's a potential second charge. So surely it's in everybody's interest to get the first one dealt with, and then. Pending the result of that, and I mean, well, the second charge is absolutely immaterial. You know, they've got to make a ruling on whether the first sanction was legitimate or not. And the fact that there's a second one hanging in the wind is neither here nor there. They have got to adjudicate on what they've been told to adjudicate on, and not bother about what's coming in or what's potentially in the future. So why is it taking so damn long? It's ridiculous.
Well, I think one of the reasons...
Are they doing it in their spare time? Or are these three guys, whoever they are, sat together 8 hours a day, poring over the evidence, writing a document that could be however many pages long? Or are they just doing it in the evening? Kind of, well, I've had my tea, and before I sit down and watch Coronation Street, I'll have a look at this for half an hour. And I'll maybe ring one of the other guys who's suddenly, I'm in the middle of watching Emmerdale. Bugger off, I'll ring you back after. What's going on? The integrity of the game is at stake here, and the livelihoods of hundreds and hundreds of people, never mind the anguish on the fan base. That's going through, wanting to know, are we going to get the 10 points back? Are we not going to get them back? Are we only getting however many back? I mean, there's a question, because people are saying, people are suggesting, we'll get six of them back, they'll only dock us four, or we'll get four of them back, they'll only dock us six. If that were to happen, are they going to justify why the 10 points has been reduced to whatever? If that were to be the case,
I think they have to, and I think they have to because of the change of approach that Everton have taken in going to the appeal.
So, just for argument's sake, I mean, you know, humour me. If this new commission decides that the 10 points was harsh, so we're going to give Everton two or three or four of them back. So the deduction will be six, seven, or eight. Could Everton appeal that as well?
Sorry, Andy, say that again.
Could Everton appeal the result of the appeal?
No. no, whatever the appeal commission decision is the final decision.
Right. Okay.
And there's no recourse. There's no recourse with the Premier League. There's no recourse with the commission.
VAR.
No, this is absolutely, this is it. Whatever the decision is, this decision stands. There's nowhere else in law that Everton can go to, either within the Premier League or anywhere else.
Right.
So whatever they come back with is what is going to happen to us. So that's...
Sorry, Paul, I'll get as basic as Andy too. When do you expect this decision to be made public?
I would suspect it's probably going to be early April.
Early April.
Yeah.
And when was the appeal from Everton submitted? Before Christmas?
Well, no, the appeal was heard last week.
Oh, the appeal was heard last week?
It was heard Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of last week.
Right.
And it's going to take them all that time to mull it over to come to a decision?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about, you know, what is actually the appeal about. The appeal itself is not just a rehash of the first commission. It's not just Everton representing the same evidence and saying, right, we want you to reconsider this. There's an element of that. But actually, and it's my understanding, okay, so this is... and I'm not going to explain why, but this is my understanding. So we've gone back and said, essentially, what happened in the commission is against our fundamental rights as an organisation. I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but under the European Convention of Human Rights, Article 6 says everybody, and a body in legal terms is not just an individual, it can be a company, it has the right to a fair trial. And it's Everton's supposition that the initial commission, okay, not a trial, but it is a case that has a legal standing, a legal bearing, so the same principles apply, was that the commission, the way that the commission went about its duty, the way that the commission was constructed, and how it dealt with Everton's mitigation, you know, its defence, was incorrect, and therefore our right to a fair trial was denied. And if in looking at how do you present that case, there are effectively two tests. One's a subjective test, and one is an objective test. The subjective test looks at who are the people that were involved in the process, and looks at the conduct of the people within the process, looks at whether they were partial or whether they were impartial, and that may be based on, you know, who they represented in the past, what their commercial relationships are, any predispositions that they bring to the appeal, right, based on previous behaviours. So that's the subjective bit. And that's where you question the independence of the appeal,
right?
And you can pull into that the fact that, you know, how the Premier League completely cocked up this idea of whether or not there should be a 10-point penalty. No, there's not supposed to be a prescribed penalty because it's supposed to be independent, and because, as Richard Masters said, as we talked about last week, you have an open sanctions policy. Yet clearly, halfway through the process, the Premier League came up with some form of formula, which nobody's quite sure whether it was accepted or not accepted. If it wasn't accepted, it's just a bizarre coincidence that the result that the Commission came up with was identical to what the formula presented in the first instance, even though there's supposed to be no prescribed penalties in place. So that's the first thing, which is like the subjective stuff. And that's where we're not necessarily talking about fact, but we're looking at all the different things surrounding the case itself. And then you look at effectively what's known as an objective test. And that's where you're looking at what happened within the commission itself that either gives the case that Everton received a fair hearing, a fair trial, or they didn't. And Everton's argument is that we didn't get a fair trial because of the way that the Premier League dealt with the mitigating factors as we saw them. And, you know, we saw it was quite clear what our mitigating factors were. It was the stadium, the fact that we were building the stadium at the same time as admittedly spending a lot of money on players, and all of the technical treatments of, you know, how interest payment was dealt with throughout that period. But also, you know, the fact that we wouldn't have borrowed money from commercial lenders and taken Mashiri's money had we not been building the stadium in the first instance. So was there any consideration within the commission given to that? It appears not from what is written about the commission's findings and their reasoning behind it. So that's one very objective one piece of objective analysis, that it was unfair that the commission didn't consider the fact that we're or didn't properly consider the fact that we were building the stadium. We also argued that they didn't properly consider the impact that the pandemic had, particularly on Everton, given where we were within the investment process, i.e. Mashiri was still in the, we need to spend lots of money on players, we need to spend lots of money on players' wages before we get any results from that. So if you, it doesn't matter whether you're successful or not, you always have to make the investment before you get the return on the investment. So the return on the investment was European, ultimately was playing European football, generating lots of revenue from European football in future years. But that's the key point. It's in future years. It's not going to happen overnight. So you have to make that expenditure first in order to get the return at a later date, particularly when you're coming from such an uncompetitive position as we were when Mashiri first arrived. The fact that the, you know, the top teams were already well established meant that we had to spend more than the top teams in order to catch up with them. But the rewards for doing that, if we did it properly, don't come until a later date. The fact that we didn't do it properly and therefore we didn't get any of the rewards is probably not something that we can defend. But what we can defend is having made that investment in the playing squad and the results of that. Did the commission take that properly into account? Particularly then when you look at the pandemic, okay, the pandemic affected all Premier League football clubs. Everybody accepts that. But did it affect Everton more than anybody else, given one, the stadium, and given two, where we were in terms of the investment cycle? And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly of all, is the impact of what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine. And Mashiri could argue that his long-term plan was always that not only would Usmanov have provided the money that he did in terms of sponsorship up to the point where Russia invaded Ukraine, but he was always going to pay for a large element of the stadium in terms of naming rights. And that there was the prospect of getting some of those naming rights paid in advance. So we got the 30 million paid in advance, and then there was the prospect of getting, I think it was £10 million a year before the stadium was completed, all of which would have significantly reduced the losses. And at the end of the day, the losses that we made, the difference between us being compliant and not being compliant, was calculated at £19.5 million. And Everton's argument is, or I, from what I know in the appeal, was that our right to a fair trial was denied through both the subjectivity in terms of who the people were in the appeal, hearing the appeal and how the appeal was heard, and then the objectivity of the appeal not taking properly into account the three factors that I've just mentioned.
Right.
All of that is an entirely new and separate legal argument. And okay, it took us 3 days for what was the gentleman's name? Lawrence Rabinovich.
Yeah,
I think his name was the so-called Super Silk. I'm not going to use the other name that people have been calling him. You know, it took 3 days to present that. Now, all of those points are serious and significant points, and
right.
Even though, as in answering your earlier question, whatever the decision is made, that is the decision. They need to be seriously considered, and so that's why it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
I
totally agree with you that it makes a mockery of the idea of justice if it goes against us, because we're not going to get those 10 points back for that period of time, even if we got them all back. And of course then we've got the second process, which is the second charge, all of which has to happen before the end of the season. So even though I think we've presented a much more different and a much better case in the appeal than we did in the first instance, it's still going to cause us massive problems towards the end of the season.
Right.
Sorry, did that make sense?
Yeah,
that was pretty good.
Yeah, I
got a bit lost in places, but I thought, are you actually presenting this case to them? It was pretty good. And grown up. And the only bit that I would cavil at is that, I thought, although we were all shocked and horrified by the 10 points and all the implications of it, and the squad has done really well to sort of nullify that huge punishment. Before those 10 points were deducted, everybody did say we did screw up fiscally.
Yeah, I don't think anywhere in what I said, and certainly anywhere with what the club has said, are we claiming that we didn't screw up, that we didn't make mistakes.
But Paul, as I remember the figures, our COVID expenses were like twice what half the league were putting in for.
Absolutely they were. They were way beyond anybody else's. I think Aston Villa were the next club in terms of size, and ours was more than double that. But
why?
The argument will be the mitigating factors of trying to expand the squad, the team, improve the squad, improve the team, trying to pay more competitive, bigger wages in order to attract bigger, better players at a time when COVID hit. And at a time before any success was witnessed on the pitch. Now, there was no success on the pitch because we screwed up both in terms of our recruitment, but we also screwed up in terms of who we recruited, both as manager and directors of football over that period, which is clearly Mashiri's, of Mashiri's doing, nobody else's. The board of directors legally are culpable, but we all know that it was. Ultimately, it was Mashiri's decision on most of these things. That's why we claim so much over COVID. And, it's an argument that had it been an argument that the Premier League wanted to argue against, then they would have done so. The fact is that they didn't argue against it, but that's not Everton's case. Everton's case is that they didn't take it into consideration sufficiently.
Right, I understand.
So, you've got three choices here. You can argue against the case. So, it's outrageous the amount that you claim for COVID, and we're not allowing you to claim that amount. We're pretty neutral on what you claimed and what the impact of it was. We don't think it impacted you as much as you think it might have done. Or, yes, we totally agree with you. Now, Everton obviously want the third option. Yes, we totally agree with you, and we understand entirely why COVID had a bigger effect on you than it had on everybody else. The Premier League's approach is somewhere in the middle. So they're not arguing the figures with regards to COVID, but Everton are saying, well, okay, that's fine, but you're not also taking it as a point of mitigation neither. You're ignoring it. You're being you know, the three choices, negative, positive or neutral in the middle, you're too much in the middle. And you're not taking this into account enough. And we need the Premier League, well, not the Premier League, but we need the appeal board to accept the argument that this should be considered more. And if it is considered more, it probably reduces the amount by which we were in breach, and therefore the penalties should be lower. You've then got the argument over and above all of this that even if the process was wrong, even if the consideration of the facts was wrong, the decision that you made in terms of what the penalty was wrong also.
Absolutely. That bit I definitely agree with.
Yeah. So that's the final part of the argument, that even if you accepted everything else that went beforehand was correct, the decision that you made in terms of what the penalty should be is entirely inappropriate. And that
it's a bullshit thing, because when it happened with Carlos Tevez and West Ham, they went, oh no, you can't punish the fans.
Yeah.
So you've already created the precedent. Don't change it around just, you know, because we're all those paranoid blues all going, no, you've just done that because it's Everton.
No, absolutely. And if we just stick to those facts and we just say, this was the case, and you know, I believe this is how we've presented it, this is the case in terms of how the Premier League dealt with West Ham United. And it's you know, clearly written in black and white in the West Ham judgment. And it has, therefore, to apply to Everton.
Yeah.
Particularly in the context of the appeal and the second charge appearing later in the season. Because one of the aspects of the West Ham decision was how late in the season the judgment was made.
Yeah.
And that has to become a bigger and bigger consideration in Everton's case, and indeed Nottingham Forest, when Nottingham Forest have their charge held. That the longer this goes on, the closer we get to the end of the season, the greater the impact and the greater the potential unfairness of this. And ultimately, this is what this is all about now. It's about how fair has this process been, from start to finish, composition, the way that it's been run, the conclusions that you made, and ultimately the penalties that you've applied. And if any of those elements are deemed to be unfair, then effectively, the decision that the Premier League or the Commission made, rather, has to fall in the appeal process, and that's what Everton are effectively saying. So, do all of those elements pass the fairness test? Because, you know, going back to the European Convention on Human Rights, it's all about the rights to a fair trial, and if only one of these elements doesn't pass the fairness test, then you have to conclude that the process itself is unfair. Because, you know, you can't be a little bit unfair. It's either fair or it's unfair.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, there's a very clear division between the two. Obviously, there's elements of unfairness. But you're either fair or you're then unfair, and then you decide how unfair you've been. It's not something in the middle. And I think all Everton have to prove in this appeal, and I think the way that we've gone about it is to say there are elements of this whole process, that decision making and the penalty, that do not pass the fairness test, and as a result of which our trial is unfair. Therefore, the decision arisen from it, you know, can't be the correct decision.
Well, keep his fingers crossed.
And that, you know, that's a hugely challenging thing to say to what is effectively a court.
Yeah.
Because you're questioning the whole, you know, the whole shooting match, as far as they're concerned.
Well, yeah, the whole legitimacy of it.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why it's going to take that long, because assuming that we've done the job properly, and I don't want to give people false hope, but my understanding is that in the legal world, the view is that it went well, and that the case that was presented was a well-presented case. It gives us the maximum opportunity of having a successful appeal. How you define success, of course, is an entirely, different subject.
Yeah.
But we should be in a better position as a result of this than we were coming into
it. This is absolutely balmy, because the players are having to do their job under a pressure that none of the other 19 clubs in the league are under.
Yeah.
So, and you might get to April and they go, well, no. And you might get to April and they go, no, we'll give you all the points back. And everybody goes, phew. And they might get to the... and we could still...
Yeah. But then, George, when we're talking about fairness, you've then got to look at another club, say a Luton, for example, who may feel as if they're going to be safe, and then turn out that they're not safe because
Exactly.
They've decided that Everton have been unfairly treated. So being fair to us may ultimately end up being unfair to somebody else.
Mm.
Not that that should necessarily be our concern, but if we're talking about fairness, you have to be fair to all.
Well, we're a member of the Premier League. Things should be fair for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, again, I believe, that's one of the points, and certainly, that point was helped tremendously by Richard Masters when he talked about, big clubs and small clubs.
Dick.
I think our case was strengthened a lot by his presentation.
Yeah, to the DCMS.
Yeah. Because I think if the people on this appeal commission had any doubts as to the objectivity of the Premier League, what Masters said throughout was by anybody's definition entirely subjective, and any legal system at the end of the day has to be objective in order to be fair.
Agree.
So it's going to be really interesting. Of course, the club aren't going to speak about it, and the Premier League aren't going to speak about it. So no. We're going to be...
That's our job.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out, if indeed anything comes out. So, you can argue that there's already briefings in the media, not like the one I've just given, but, of a different nature. Because the Premier League will want to make, even if what has happened demonstrates the Premier League's total unsuitability in its role as regulator, they're going to present their best case right up to the bitter end. They're not going to concede any ground whilst this process runs. They're going to double down on their position.
Right.
In the hope that A, that might influence the decision, and B, that it might, it keeps them in a stronger position in the period between now and whenever the decision is made.
Well, that sounds like 777.
We haven't got time for that, bro.
Dribbling down. Everybody to get fed up.
The one interesting thing about 777, and there's no point in going through the stuff that we've been through previously, because literally nothing has moved either forwards or backwards, is the announcement that their head of data, so they're essentially one of their key people in terms of their multi-club operations, Mladen Somers, has left 777 last week to become director of football at Barnsley Football Club.
Wow.
He's gone from a multi-club setup to Oakwell.
To Barnsley. Brilliant.
Well, yeah, to be fair to Barnsley, Barnsley are part of one of the biggest multi-club operations.
All right.
Run by a group called Pacific Media, a guy called Paul Conway.
Right.
But not very successfully. Now, they don't have the same some of the same reputational issues that 777 have, let me put it that way.
Right, okay.
But if you look at how well have their clubs done under their multi-club operation, it's not very good. But anyway, that's an entirely different subject. But it is interesting that one of the people that they put much faith in, much stock in, and I certainly remember conversations I had with Dan Dransfield, Don Dransfield, was the fact that they took Mladen Tomic from Leicester City.
Right.
was a key part of their plan going forward, and clearly he's decided that there's greener grass in another field.
Barnsley Meadow.
Michael Parkinson will be so proud.
Wouldn't he?
All right, guys, should we leave it there?
Just one other thing. I mean, everybody that listens to this podcast knows quite well the way me and our kid feel about the Red Club in Manchester. But I think as today's the 5th of February, we all know what tomorrow is. It's the 66th anniversary of the Munich air crash. And I think, in fairness to any United fans that might be listening, nobody would have wished that on any football club or any football team. A great side perished, or too many of a great side perished on that fateful day in February 1958. And I think we should just remember it.
Well said indeed. Totally agree. Good stuff. Okay, gents, thank you very much. Thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you for particularly the numbers of people that listened last week, which was quite incredible. And actually the response, never had so many messages and emails and stuff. So if I've not replied to every single one, I sort of apologize a little bit. I will eventually get around to replying to them all, but just a huge response. So not only from a numbers point of view, just but from the sheer people actually think about some of the stuff that we talk about. So don't always agree with us, particularly you, George.
Yeah, I don't. I nearly said something very rude then. blank, if they can't take a joke. I can say that in that.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking. No, I mean, no. In all seriousness, thank you to everybody, and of course, George and Andy. Thank you both as well.
Always a pleasure.
Cheers, guys.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Yep. Speak to you after we've beaten City 3-0.